Welcome to 29-4 Sunday School. This is a podcast intended to supplement your weekly study of the Come Follow Me curriculum published by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm host Ben James, and every week I lead you through the lessons in a way that is intended to help you better understand the scriptures, make you think about important questions, and strengthen your faith in Jesus Christ. You can also find the video version of these lessons on my YouTube channel, titled 29-4 Sunday School. If you find these lessons useful, please consider becoming a subscriber. Enjoy the lesson. Hello, welcome to 29-4 Sunday School. Glad you can join me as we together study the Come Follow Me lesson for August 10th through 16th. And this week we will be discussing Alma chapters 53 through 63. Well, this week we continue to discuss what are known as the war chapters in the book of Alma. And we'll be discussing and covering 11 chapters, which is over 20 pages of text in the Book of Mormon. So a lot of content in this week's lesson. But similar to last week's lesson, I'm not going to do my normal format, which, as you likely know, is to kind of blow by blow go through the different chapters in order. One, because there's just so much material here that would be not possible. Two, that would just be kind of boring. As we talked about last week, these chapters are very unique, and I think it's, anyone who takes the Book of Mormon seriously and really tries to make it a part of your personal study and benefit from it spiritually, part of the challenge of these chapters is to try to understand why Mormon would spend so much space within these plates. And again, we're assuming that, these plates were not very easy to record things in. We're taking metal and essentially carving characters on that metal. And so it'd be a very difficult process to get the ideas that he wants to share on these plates. And so the assumption is that he would only put on these plates those things that he truly found to be most valuable. And here we have a lot of area within the Book of Mormon. 1/10 of the entire book is devoted to a few years of war. And so I think part of the challenge of the Book of Mormon is trying to understand why we would have Mormon spend so much effort into recording these wars, recording a lot of details about the wars too. In other parts of the Book of Mormon, we don't, you get several chapters covering dozens, if not hundreds of years, where it seems like a lot of interesting things take place. But here we've got, again, 1/10 of the book covering some wars that, expand over a considerable time, but it is still just a few years and, put in the context of greater Nephite Lamanite history, certainly is not it is not a very long period of time. Last week we talked about, some of the reasons as to why that might be, which is, of course, knowing that the Book of Mormon is written for our day. Mormon clearly felt that there were some parallels between what happened within these war chapters and the challenges that we would be facing in our day. As these things have been preserved for us. Now, clearly they were also an important part of Nephite history, and so they were preserved to the extent they were preserved by someone originally before Mormon got a hold of them. They were clearly an important part of the Nephite record. But ultimately it was Mormon that made the decision, I am going to record these on the plates as my people are falling. And I have, I, Mormon, have the promise that these plates will be preserved for future generations, that they might benefit from them. And again, so the challenge is, how are we going to benefit from them? And last week we talked about how, just as they are in a war to preserve their nationhood, to preserve their liberty, to preserve their right and their beliefs in God, so too are we in a war or in battles with adversaries to try to preserve our religious liberty, to try to preserve our beliefs in God and our rights to believe in God. And those challenges don't obviously only come from governments or from people who are trying to take our physical lives, but rather those that you know, might challenge your faith or challenge you, the things that you believe in and that you hold sacred and hold dear. So clearly, that was an important part of what we discussed last week, is that they were fighting for those things that were most sacred to them. And that is, in many ways, what our challenge is. How do we fight to preserve that which is most sacred? And in some ways, you know, one of the challenges of a war is that, as we see here, it really makes you think, what are those things that are most sacred? What are those things that I am not willing to give up? Where am I going to draw that line? Where on one side are things that are negotiable, things that, you know, maybe I could be willing to give up, or I'm not willing to put forth the effort to protect, compared to things that I am absolutely never going to move on. And we saw last week it was the religious liberty, liberty in general, and then the safety of family. Those were the things that over and over the Nephites kept saying, this is what we are fighting for. This is what is worth protecting. And so that is what the Nephites were fighting about. And so as we think about, you know, taking these lessons from these wars and comparing them to our lives, probably the same things are what we should be worth fighting for. Our personal liberty, our religious liberty, and the safety and protection and the well-being of our families. Everything else could potentially be negotiable. Everything else is, you know, you're willing to, you know, potentially put on the back burner so that you can focus on protecting those things that are most vital and truly most important. So, you know, as I try to think in my own life about how do these war chapters apply to me, that is certainly one of the take-homes that I get. Now, in today's chapters, and this lesson, I'm going to focus on one an individual, one a group of individuals that these texts, that these 11 chapters seem to really focus on. One is the 2,000 stripling warriors, as we refer to them, Helaman's army. And then the next is, we'll continue to look at Captain Moroni, because he certainly comes across as the hero in these narratives, both last week and this week as well. We'll take a look at some of the verses that discuss him and the type of man that he and the stripling warriors both were, in the hopes of being able to, from that, extrapolate some lessons that we can apply to our own lives and think of ways that we can be better, that we can be more like them, because clearly these are the two, as I see it, the two most critical figures that are focused on here. And, you know, think about what it was that Mormon was trying to have us learn by spending so much time describing these individuals and describing their actions. Now, today's chapters are interesting in that they focus on three different letters. The first is a letter between Moroni and Amaron, the king of the Lamanites. And it's a rather short letter where Moroni basically says, Amaron, you have a lot of our prisoners. We're going to exchange. These are the terms I'm going to exchange. And if you don't agree to it, then to heck with you and we're going to kill you. To which Amaron replies, well, I'm happy to exchange, but I'm not going to do it. But I'm not happy about the things that you're saying about me. And, you know, how dare you criticize me and my methods and the things that me and my people are doing. To which Moroni interestingly responds and says, well, then to heck with you. If, you know, even though you agree to my terms, you don't do so for the reasons that I want. And then Moroni summarily agrees to engage in war with him, which is a very interesting back and forth, an interesting decision by Moroni as well, one that we'll talk about in a second. And then the next letter comes from Helaman, and it's an epistle to Moroni in which he describes what happened to these stripling warriors. And it covers several chapters, and it goes into great detail, in which we see the great love that this that Helaman had for these young men that he was leading. But I think it also shows a lot about Moroni and the relationship that he had with Helaman, and also the type of general that he must have been, that his leaders were willing to share so much personal details about what was going on with their armies with him. He must have had a very close relationship and been the type that they knew that they could trust and that they could rely upon in sharing all of these details that they did. And then the final letter is epistles between Captain Moroni on one hand and Pahoran, the chief judge, the head of the government, on the other, in which Moroni, unaware of the challenges that Pahoran is facing, calls him to repentance for not supporting sufficiently his armies. And then Pahoran responds, he says, look, I would love to support your armies, but I got my own problems here and I have no way to do so. To which they, you know, lovingly come together and agree to put down the challenges that Pahoran is facing, and then they focus their efforts on on the Lamanites and the problems that they present. So we have these three epistles, very, you know, it shows Moroni in a different light in each and every one of them, but I think each one of them is enlightening in learning about Moroni and about the type of man that he is, and ways that we can be better ourselves. First, let's talk about these stripling warriors, because they are mentioned in the beginning of chapter 53. And let's first read about them in chapter 53, verse 17. And they entered into a covenant to fight for the liberty of the Nephites, yea, to protect the land unto the laying down of their lives. Yea, even they covenanted that they never would give up their liberty, but they would fight in all cases to protect the Nephites and themselves from bondage. And this is interesting because you will recall that it is their parents who also entered into a covenant, but their covenant was almost the opposite of the one that these sons, their young sons had entered into. You recall that their parents had entered into a covenant that they would never again take up their weapons, and then so they had moved from the Lamanite territory into the Nephite territory, and they were now protected by the Nephites. But now the Nephites, being involved in so many battles with the Lamanites, it's becoming increasingly difficult to offer them protection, and they were about to break the covenant that they had made to. And then these sons step forward, and they say, well, our parents entered into that covenant, and we don't want them to break that covenant. That is a sacred bond with that they have made between them and the Lord. We are going to help them preserve that covenant by making a covenant of our own, that we will take up arms to protect liberties, to defend the Nephites. And that is the covenant that we will make. So it's interesting here that the covenant that the parents and the children are making seem to be almost exactly opposite. But yet it was clearly the appropriate thing to do. And certainly these young men made a very serious covenant with the Lord and with each other that they would defend and protect liberty, even to the laying down of their own lives. Even they'd put their own lives at stake because this thing was so important. So we learn here the power of covenants, both that they would protect the covenants that their parents had made, and they themselves would enter into covenants. Now, clearly, these covenants are different than the covenants that are associated with the saving ordinances that we enter into when we are baptized or when we go to the temple. I think these are different types of covenants, but nonetheless, covenants that they take very seriously. And if they take these covenants so seriously, how more so should we take our baptismal covenants and our temple covenants with the utmost seriousness as well? And as a result of them entering into these covenants, I think it's beautiful that they had taken what previously was a weakness or a vulnerability to the Nephites, the fact that they were obligated to protect the Ammonites, the people, the anti-Nephi Lehites. They had previously been a liability to the Nephites, and all of a sudden, because of the covenants that these young men make, this group of people now becomes a strength because of these young men. It's beautiful how it works out. You can imagine the Ammonites for years had felt almost certainly gratitude, but also probably some guilt, and that the Nephites had expended so much resources in defending and protecting them. And whereas they previously had felt guilt and immense gratitude, I'm sure now it's a different type of gratitude, that now are they no longer passively reliant upon the Nephites to protect them, but rather they can actually participate in protecting this nation that has provided them with so much. Verse 21, "Yea, they were men of truth and soberness, for they had been taught to keep the commandments of God and to walk uprightly before Him." And I think this is an interesting verse. It seems to make a comparison, or to a distinction, I should say, between two concepts. One is keeping the commandments of God. Clearly we should be teaching our children to keep the commandments of God. But it also adds another thing that they learn, and that is walking uprightly before God, which it seems the way it's presented here is different than keeping the commandments. Walking uprightly before God is more than just keeping the commandments. And I like to think of it, and at least the way it makes sense to me, is that, the keeping the commandments is the automatic responses, you could say the robotic responses of, someone who has their checklist and they're trying to go through that to make sure that they don't do anything wrong. And certainly there is a place for that. I don't want to put that down and say that we should ignore the importance of keeping the commandments. Clearly not. We should be familiar with the commandments and trying to do our best to keep them. But the idea of walking uprightly before God seems to be a higher notion, and that more than just obediently and robotically keeping the commandments, but rather we are living our lives and, as confronted with difficult situations, making the decisions that are pleasing to God. Think of Adam in the garden, where he has two conflicting commandments given to him. One, don't partake of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the other, to stay with the woman that the Lord has given to him. The situation came up in which it was not possible for him to keep both commandments. So what did Adam do? Adam chose to walk uprightly before God. Adam looked at the situation, and he balanced the conflicting interests here, and he made the decision that he believed that God wanted him to make. And that is also the situation that these young men were put in. Clearly, on the one hand, they had been taught by their parents of the dangers of being engaged in violent activity. No doubt these parents, who had themselves entered into a covenant that they would in all circumstances not participate in violence, had clearly taught their children to do the same thing. So for these children then to at a certain age, enter into a covenant that they would take up weapons to defend their families, must have been a very difficult decision. Must have, in some ways, gone against the very teachings of their parents. It must have been very, very heart-wrenching decision for them to make. But ultimately, they knew it was what they should do. No doubt they had prayed about it and received inspiration about it. No doubt there had been sharing of testimonies and different feelings amongst themselves. And ultimately, they came to the hard decision that even though they had grown up in a society and grown up with parents that had in all circumstances told them, do not participate in violence, even war, even to defend yourselves. Look at the example that we did. Remember, these are the people that threw down their weapons, had the Lamanites attack them, and had seen their friends slaughtered, and they were willing to continue to do so. These were people that took this seriously, this idea that we should not engage in warring activities. And then for their children to turn around and enter into covenants that they would engage in war activities in order to protect and preserve their liberties. That must have been a very difficult decision for them. And in my mind, it most likely went against what they thought in some ways or had been trained to believe were the commandments of God. But they made the decision that they believed was right for them. They made the decision to walk uprightly before God in a situation where they had two commandments that were so difficult to keep, really impossible to keep both of them. And in my mind, that is what walking uprightly before God is. It's recognizing the complexities of life, recognizing that sometimes there are no simple solutions and simple check the box, keep the commandments approaches in some ways just don't work. In some ways aren't able to get the job done and really isn't necessarily what the Lord wants either. And so it's in those situations that we get on our knees, ask the Lord for guidance, and then move forward in faith, trusting, despite what those around us might say, even those who love us and have the best intentions, even those that are keeping the commandments themselves might not always recognize the situation that we're in. And so, would that we would all be like the stripling warriors and always choosing to walk uprightly before God in every situation. Let's turn to chapter 56 as we continue to learn more about these young men. And it is important, I think, to recognize that they are young. I think sometimes in the artwork we see these, full-grown, hulking, war machines going off to defend their people. But the idea of a stripling itself, a stripling means someone who is in the process of passing from boyhood to manhood. And I think the whole reason that why these young men are so notable is because they are young men. These are not 22-year-old fully developed men out there. It seems to me that the reason Helaman is so delighted that they fought so valiantly and that they were all protected was because these were young men and they were vulnerable. These are probably your 13, 14, 15-year-old young boys. Those that might be passing the sacrament in our own wards and branches that are out there defending their families. Again, it would probably be noteworthy if they were older, but the reason I think that Helaman is devoting so much ink to them, and Mormon is as well, is because these are so young and it is so miraculous and they are so brave that you had these truly young men that were willing to go and fight in order to protect their families and to preserve their liberties. So again, as we think about this, think of the young men passing the sacrament or serving as ushers, the 13, the 14-year-olds in your ward and branch, and think of them when you think of Helaman's army and the brave decisions that they made to go and attack stand up for their families and to engage in battle with the war-hardened Lamanites. So again, we turn to chapter 56, verses 47 through 48, these famous verses. Now they never had fought, yet they did not fear death, and they did think more upon the liberty of their fathers than they did upon their lives. Yea, they had been taught by their mothers that if they did not doubt, God would deliver them. And they rehearsed unto me the words of their mother, saying, we do not doubt. Our mothers knew it. Famous verses, the influence, the incredible influence that mothers have on them. And again, clearly of the things that their mothers were teaching them, passivity, peace, not engaging in violence was certainly one of them. But here, as they move on and enter into new covenants and recognize that walking uprightly before God will require them to do things different from what their parents had covenanted to do, the lesson that they're recalling from their mothers was that if you do not doubt, God will deliver you. And that is obviously a lesson that their mothers knew well, that they had been delivered. These are people whose families had been attacked by Lamanites, even though that they had taken up a covenant that they would not engage in battle. And they had been delivered, they had been spared, and then they had been protected by the Nephites. And so their mothers knew well that if they trusted in God, God would deliver them. What I want to take away from these verses is the idea that, again, their mothers taught them, do not doubt. And then the next verse, they say, we do not doubt that our mothers knew it. So our mothers taught us not to doubt, and we do not doubt. And our mothers know that we do not doubt. And I think that is an important lesson as we, again, take these principles from these war chapters and apply them to the battle that we are engaged in these latter days, as we think about our own testimonies and the testimonies that we're trying to instill in our children, and the danger that doubt plays in that process. And we need to be careful here. There's absolutely nothing wrong with asking questions. There's nothing wrong with wondering why something is the way it is, and then putting forth the effort to dig deeper and to understand. But we need to make sure that as we do so, we do that with an eye of faith, not with an eye of doubt. Because in my mind, those are two opposite notions. As you're confronted with something that doesn't make sense in your own life, or something in church history, or in church doctrine, or in the actions of a bishop or another leader, you know, there's two ways to look at those difficult situations, at those questions that we will have. One is with the eye of doubt, in which you begin to assume the worst, in which you begin to look for answers that will confirm your doubt, basically. And you'll be able to find those. You'll be able to find explanations as to why things are happening that are not faithful, that will confirm your doubt. Well, on the other hand, if you look for answers with an eye of faith, you'll be able to find those answers, those explanations as well. So in many ways, it comes down to, as you are confronted with challenges, as you are confronted with issues that you do not understand, do you view those issues with an eye of faith, as the young men here had been taught by their mothers to do, or do you view them with an eye of doubt? Because whether you view with faith or with doubt, you're going to find answers that will confirm whatever it is you are, whatever direction you're looking, whatever means that you are using to understand these situations. You will find that confirmation. And so the question is not real. So the most important question is really, how do you approach these things? Is it with faith or with doubt? And these young men were taught, if you do not doubt, if you look with faith, you will find the answers that you need, and the Lord will deliver you. The Lord will set your mind free, will set your concerns at ease, and you will be delivered. Chapter 57, verses 26 through 27. And now their preservation was astonishing to our whole army, yea, that they should be spared, while there was a thousand of our brethren who were slain. And we do justly ascribe it to the miraculous power of God, because of their exceeding faith, and that which they had been taught to believe, that there was a just God, and whosoever did not doubt, that they should be preserved by his marvelous power. Now this was the faith of those of these of whom I have spoken. They are young and their minds are firm, and they do put their trust in God continually. What a wonderful description of these great young men, that they were protected, they were preserved, and it was miraculous. And how wonderful of Helaman that he is able to recognize the miracle as it is presented before him. But the reason that this miracle came about was because of the exceeding faith and that which they had been taught to believe. They had been taught to have faith, and they had faith in it. They did not doubt it. When challenges arose, they leaned on the side of faith. They chose to exercise their faith rather than to embellish their doubts. And that's what Helaman ascribes to the fact that they were preserved and that they were protected. And that's what we have to make sure in our own lives. That's what protects and preserves us, and also our children as well. Their minds were firm, and they do put their trust in God continually, which I think is such an important idea. Trusting in God is not just something that happens once a week or when we actually need it. If we only put our trust in God when difficulties arise, that might not be enough. We need to put our trust in God continually in everything that we do, so that when difficulties arise, we know how to call upon the Lord and receive the deliverance that we seek. Chapter 58, verse 11. Yea, and it came to pass that the Lord our God did visit us with assurances that he would deliver us, yea, insomuch that he did speak peace to our souls, and did grant unto us great faith, and did cause us that we should hope for our deliverance in him. So I love that they obviously had a continual communication with the Lord, and that the Lord did was able to speak with him, and they were able to recognize the communications that the Lord had with them. One important thing to teach our young people and to make sure we have in our own lives, so that when challenges arise, we have that communication with the Lord, so that when it feels like something doesn't make sense, or when we start to have questions that would serve to rock the foundation of our faith and of our lives, that we know where to turn for answers, and we know where to turn for peace as much as anything. So, and that's what it says, yea, in so much that he did speak peace to our souls. He didn't necessarily give them the answers that they were seeking for, but he did give them peace. And so much of the time, that's really all that we can seek for. Answers to difficult questions sometimes take years to come. Sometimes they never come in this life. So we need to make sure that as we are confronted with challenges, in addition to seeking for answers, what we are really seeking for is peace. What we are really seeking for is that confirmation from the Lord that even though we don't know all the answers, that we are on the right path and he is there guiding us, protecting us, and loving us. That is what we need to make sure that we are seeking for and that we teach our children to be seeking for. Look for answers, but seek for peace. That is what is most important, and that is what the Lord is most able to deliver to us. Answers, sometimes we have to discover those for ourselves. The Lord can't just spoon feed us all the answers, because that would inhibit our growth. But he will always provide us the peace that we need as we strive for it. And finally, chapter 58, verse 40, a final verse to describe these 2,060 incredible young people. But behold, they have received many wounds. Nevertheless, they stand fast in that liberty wherewith God has made them free. And they are strict to remember the Lord their God from day to day. Yea, they do observe to keep his statutes and his judgments and his commandments continually. And their faith is strong in the prophecies concerning that which is to come. And that which is to come is, of course, Jesus Christ, the promise that we will be delivered from our gravest challenge, which is spiritual death, which comes from the sins that we commit and our separation from God, and from physical death, knowing that we will be separated from our loved ones at some point. And that which is to come, that which they had faith in, that which they had trusted in, was the promise that Christ would come and deliver us from both of those deaths. Now, I do think there is one of the reasons Mormon was willing to spend so much real estate within the plates and talking about these young men is because there is a great messianic comparable between these young men and between what the Savior did. If you think about it, the parents of these young men had been put in a difficult situation in which they themselves had made a covenant, and because of that covenant, they could not do the things that was necessary in order to help defend and preserve and protect and deliver the Nephites. They could not do it without breaking the covenants. And in the same way, our Heavenly Father, who desires to save us, who desires to preserve us, is in some way limited in his ability to do so, and that he cannot come down here to deliver us. He has already been exalted. He has already been perfected and received his throne. For whatever reason, he is not able to come down here and personally deliver us from our challenges and from our struggles. He requires a mediator to do so. Because if he were to come down so, if he were to come down and deliver ourselves, that would violate some of the laws that he is subject to, perhaps some of the covenants that he has entered into. He would cease to be God, as Alma teaches us, if he were to come in and violate those covenants. So instead of coming down himself, who does he turn to? He turns to his son to provide that deliverance. He turns to his son to restore a balance that has been lost. And that balance has been lost because of the mistakes that we make. Of course, he is the one that sent us here because he loves us and he wants us to obtain the growth that is promised to us. But as a result of us coming here, we are put in a position where we cannot return to his presence on our own. And he cannot come down here and personally save us as well, lest he violate the covenants that he has made or violate the strictures of justice as we understand them. He is not able to personally deliver us. Therefore, he sends his son to do so. He prepares the path. And so in the same way that Christ, acting on behalf of the Father, is able to deliver us from our situation, so too do the stripling warriors, these sons of the anti-Nephi Lehis, so too do they come and help to deliver the Nephite nation that is so critical to them. Also, these young men were given the option not to go forward. They had several instances in which there was armies pursuing them, who had later turned to fought other armies, and therefore they could have left. They could have protected themselves, but no. Instead of doing so, they chose to go forward. They chose the harder path. They chose to live up to the covenant that they had made, just as Christ had the option. It was voluntary on his part to come and atone for us. His atonement had to be voluntary. It could not be something that was compelled upon him. Otherwise, in some ways, it would have lost its efficacy. So just as these young men had the opportunity to turn back, but they bravely and faithfully chose to go forward, so too did Christ choose to go forward and fulfill the purposes for which he came to this earth in atoning for our sins, making it possible to protect and preserve our liberty so that we have the ability to return to our Father. And then finally, just as Christ carried out his mission perfectly and making it possible for every single one of our fathers and our heavenly parents' children to be saved and to return to their presence, so too did these young men carry out their missions perfectly. And even though they were wounded, even though they were beaten, even though they suffered grave injury, they carried out their missions perfectly, and not a single one of them was lost. And so I think there's some beautiful parallels between these stripling warriors, this army of courageous young men, preserving the liberties of their parents, helping to deliver the Nephite nation from danger, and Jesus Christ, as he, on behalf of his Father, came down and perfectly fulfilled his mission, making it possible for us too to be delivered. Now with that, let's focus on Captain Moroni for a few minutes and some of the lessons we learn about him from these chapters. Chapter 55, verse 2. And he said, "Behold, I will not exchange prisoners with Amoron, save he will withdraw his purpose, as I have stated in my epistle. For I will not grant unto him that he shall have any more power than what he hath got." And one of the lessons I learn about Moroni from here, and again, this goes back to this exchange of epistles between Moroni and Amoron, in which Moroni says, "Here's the terms. You terrible, horrible person for engaging in this war. I condemn you, but here's the terms that I'm willing to exchange prisoners on." And then Amoron responds and says, "I am not a terrible, horrible person. If I am, you are too. I'm doing the right thing. Agree to the terms." And Moroni says, "Well, even though we agree to the terms, I don't agree for the reason that you're doing it. Therefore, let's call the whole thing off." which is what he says in verse 2. Save, he will withdraw his purpose. Unless you agree that you're doing the wrong thing and that you're willing to stop these wicked wars that you've engaged in, I will not exchange prisoners. Again, which is an interesting conclusion. They agreed to exchange prisoners. They agreed on the terms of the prisoners. But Moroni, he recognized and he cares about people's motives and the purposes for doing things. He's not just a robot. He's not just, as we talked about earlier, one of those, you know, check the list type of commandment keepers. But he wants to make sure he's doing things for the right reason. And he cares that other people are also doing things for the right reason, not just checking the box. And so here he was, even though they had agreed on the terms, he calls the whole thing off because Amaron would not recognize the error of his ways, the mistakes and the wickedness that he was engaging. Because Moroni knew that even if he agreed, even though they agreed to the terms, if they exchanged prisoners, the wars would just continue. And so Moroni made the decision, you know, if the wars are going to continue, then let's not exchange. And, you know, I'm comfortable in my position that I'm willing to go to continue these wars because I'm doing so for the right purpose. So we have to make sure that we do things for the right purpose. And we're not just, again, mindless check-the-box commandment keepers, but rather that we are doing things for the reasons that they should be done, not just doing the right things. 55 verse 19. But behold, this was not the desire of Moroni. He did not delight in murder or bloodshed, but he delighted in the saving of his people from destruction. And for this cause, he might not bring upon him injustice. He would not fall upon the Lamanites and destroy them in their drunkenness. So here they had the opportunity to murder, as part of the war, a number of Lamanites who they had gotten drunk and were in a very vulnerable position. And for a second time, we saw him do this earlier in last week's readings. He says, yeah, I could take advantage and I could kill a lot of people, but that's not my purpose. I'm not in here to kill a bunch of Lamanites. I'm in here to defend my freedom. I've already achieved my purposes, and therefore I am going to spare the lives of those who I am in very well positioned to take at this moment. So Moroni was clearly a man of high principles, and he strived to keep those principles. And obviously that's how we should be. And we, you know, need to make sure we do so not in a self-righteous manner, but you know, we should absolutely and under all circumstances make sure that we keep the high principles that we ascribe to. And we need to recognize that we do have high principles as members of the church. The gospel of Jesus Christ has the highest of principles that I'm aware of. And we strive to keep those high principles. And we don't do so because we think we're better than anyone else. We do so because we believe that that is the pattern, the method that the Lord has given us to help us to become better. And we humbly strive to become the best that we can while recognizing that not everyone subscribes to those same principles. And while we wish that they would, we don't judge others if they don't believe in the same principles that we do, because they haven't learned and experienced the same things that we do. So we need to make sure that we remain humble as we interact with those around us. 55 verse 31. But behold, the Nephites were not slow to remember the Lord their God in this their time of affliction. They could not be taken in their snares, yea, they would not partake of the wine, save they had first given to some of the Lamanite prisoners. Love this, that Moroni, even though, as he's engaged in the war, as he's leading these Nephite people, he makes sure that they do not let their guard down, and that they are always remembering the Lord. And I think that is the reason why it's important to continually remember the Lord. That's why we study our scriptures daily. That's why we engage in prayer daily. That's why we're, as part of our the covenant that we renew as we partake of the sacrament, we covenant to always remember the Lord. We never want to let our guard down, because there's temptations all the time and they sneak up in unexpected circumstances. And so it's important to always remember the Lord and be like Moroni and never letting our guard down. Chapter 60 now, we're going to read verse 13 as we continue to learn more about Moroni. Chapter 60, verse 13. For the Lord suffereth the righteous to be slain, that his justice and judgment may come upon the wicked. Therefore ye need not suppose that the righteous are lost because they are slain, but behold, they do enter into the rest of the Lord their God. And this is part of Moroni's letter to Pahoran, as he is under the assumption that Pahoran is being negligent in his duties. Of course, he later learns that that is not the case, in which case he repents and goes and defends and helps Pahoran. But I love this verse because it shows the eternal perspective that Moroni had. Even though he was engaged in a very temporary activity, he's engaged in war, defending his physical freedoms of himself and his people, a very, very material, earthly activity, one that in many ways, at the end of the day, once you know we've all left this earth, really is in some ways not that important from an eternal perspective. And it is that eternal perspective that Moroni was always able to keep, even though he was engaged in this most temporal of activities as he was the captain of the Nephite armies. He always maintained that eternal perspective, keeping in mind that this is part of a much bigger process that we are all involved in, an eternal process. And it's not just a war for trying to preserve physical life, but rather spiritual life is what truly matters the most. And it's incredible that Moroni, as he spent his entire life engaged in these physical wars, was able to always maintain that eternal perspective. Verse 21, also in chapter 60, as he continues to chide Pahoran due to a misunderstanding, he says, "Or do you suppose that the Lord will still deliver us while we sit upon our thrones and do not make use of the means which the Lord has provided for us?" And from this, I take that Moroni is a man of action. He recognizes that he's received a lot from the Lord, and his job is not to just sit and enjoy the things that the Lord has provided for him, trying to make this life as pleasurable as possible, but rather he recognizes that because of the blessings the Lord has given to him, he has great responsibilities to use those blessings to benefit others, to preserve the freedoms of others, and to fail to do so is to fail to live up to his potential and the expectations that the Lord has for him. Chapter 60, verse 36. "Behold, I am Moroni, your chief captain. I seek not for power, but to pull it down. I seek not for honor of the world, but for the glory of my God and the freedom and welfare of my country. And thus I close my epistle." So I love that his heart is in the right place. He doesn't seek for power, but to pull it down. He doesn't seek for honor of the world, but the glory of God and the freedom and welfare of his country. He's doing the right things for the right purposes. And I think if we were to describe Moroni and, you know, try to summarize what Moroni stood for, that is what it would be: doing the right thing for the right reason. And that is what Moroni always, always strived to do. And he's just such an incredible example. Again, Mormon loved this guy. He named his son after him. And that is one of the reasons, you know, Mormon spent so many chapters, so many pages describing these battles and the actions of Captain Moroni, because Mormon loves this guy. And I think we should too. He must have been an absolutely incredible general. And I certainly hope to have the chance to, you know, shake his hand you know, gain from his wisdom and experience in a future date. Chapter 62, verse 43, a final thought on this incredible captain. "And Moroni yielded up the command of his armies into the hands of his son, whose name was Moronihah, and he retired to his own house that he might spend the remainder of his days in peace." And I love this because it shows that even though he spent his entire life fighting the Lamanites, he knew when it was time to step down, and he did so gracefully, exiting the stage when it was the appropriate time for him to do so, and showing forth humility as he did so, turning the command over to others and then leaving others to fulfill and carry out the obligations that are now theirs and are no longer his, not striving to hold on to power for as long as he absolutely could. Again, Moroni, certainly one of my heroes. Can't wait to meet him and learn from him. I think there's so much that we can gain from the example that he sets in the chapters that we have here preserved in Alma. So here, these war chapters conclude, and I just want to share two verses from chapter 62, or two sets of verses that I think summarize some of the takeaways from these war chapters. One is 62 verse 41. "But behold, because of the exceeding great length of the war between the Nephites and the Lamanites, many had become hardened because of the exceedingly great length of the war, and many were softened because of their afflictions, insomuch that they did humble themselves before God, even in the depth of humility." And so here we see two different sets of people that react to the same stimulus, the same situations, in two very different ways. Some, these long wars had the result of hardening their hearts, while others, in humility, turned to God and they humbled themselves and their hearts were softened. So these same wars had the effect of hardening some hearts and softening others. And we need to be ready for that because of the wars that we are engaged in our lives, especially as we strive to preserve our faith and our testimonies, to defend the things that we know and love and hold to be true. The result of these wars is that many will become more hardened. Many will look at the challenges confronting the church to its growth, the challenges to its history, the recognition that, you know, Joseph Smith was a human that made mistakes, as was every single prophet after him, including our living prophet today. Many will look at those and their hearts will become hardened because of the difficulties that they see. While others, on the other hand, will be humbled because of those difficulties, and those humilities will soften, and those challenges will soften their hearts and cause them to draw closer to the Lord. And again, it's not a different in stimulus. It's not a difference in events. It's the same events impacting different people in different ways. Some people causing their hearts to be hardened, some people causing their hearts to be softened. And it seems like the difference between the two is that some humbled themselves before God, even in the depth of humility. If we become prideful as we strive to understand challenging and difficult situations, assuming that we are capable of understanding everything, assuming that there are answers and that we either know them or are capable of finding them, there's a real risk that our hearts will become hardened. Whereas if we become humble and say, you know what, there's some stuff that I just don't understand, but that's okay because I do understand and I do know that God loves me and that God has my best interests in mind. And as I move forward, I'm able to, because of that faith in God, set some of my questions aside and move forward in faith. Then our hearts will remain soft and will become even softer as we move forward with humility. Same stimulus, different results in different people, and the catalyst that causes those different results appears to be whether or not we are humble and are willing to call upon the Lord in humility as we confront the challenges that we face. Finally, verses 48 through 51, still in chapter 62. "And the people of Nephi began to prosper again in the land, and began to multiply and to wax exceedingly strong again in the land, and they began to grow exceedingly rich. But notwithstanding their riches or their strength or their prosperity, they were not lifted up in the pride of their eyes, neither were they slow to remember the Lord their God, but they did humble themselves exceedingly before him. Yea, they did remember how great things the Lord had done for them, that he had delivered them from death and from bonds and from prison and from all manner of afflictions, and he had delivered them out of the hands of their enemies. And they did pray unto the Lord their God continually, insomuch that the Lord did bless them according to his word, so that they did wax strong and prosper in the land." Now that these wars are over, now that some of these challenges are behind them, they confront a new challenge, that of prosperity, which is a very different challenge from the challenge of war. And as those that had become softened in their hearts because of the challenges of war were able to remain humble during prosperity, and their hearts remained softened during this new challenge. So I think the challenge for each of us is that regardless of where you are in your life, regardless of you're in the war period of your life or you're in the prosperity period of your life, and obviously it's possible to be in both periods and at the same time in some ways, given the different circumstances and the complexities of life, but regardless of whether in the immediate present, the situation that we're confronting is a warlike situation or a prosperity-like situation, the solution to both is humility, maintaining a soft heart, continually calling upon the Lord, seeking revelation, trusting that He is capable of delivering us, having that faith in Him, setting aside our doubts, humbly recognizing that we don't know everything, but the Lord does. And if we will remain close to Him, He is capable of delivering us. So these war chapters, we now come to the conclusion of them after 2 weeks of large amounts of material that we're not able to go through in the normal manner just because of their size. I think they do have these beautiful takeaways, and I love how they're wrapped up so nicely in this chapter 62. We confront challenges, we confront these wars in our lives. Sometimes we confront the challenge of prosperity, but the solution is always humility. And I pray that we will remain humble, that we will continually call upon the Lord, expecting His deliverance, knowing that He is always there, always able to deliver us from whatever challenge we have in our lives. And I do so in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.